And now, from the gleaming spires of Chicago, broadcasting to Niflheim, Svartalfheim, Olympus, throughout the nine worlds and beyond, the only Thor podcast hosted by a true descendant of Odin. You are tuned to the immortal sounds of Radio Free Asgard.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Radio Free Asgard. This is episode number 190, and we're coming at you, as we always do, from beautiful Chicago, Illinois. My name is Tom Harris, and I'm your host, and welcome to a very special edition of Radio Free Asgard, because this week we're going to be looking at the Lee Kirby run. By that, I don't strictly mean the Lee Kirby run. I mean, basically, the whole beginning of the Thor series, from his introduction in Journey into Mystery all the way into the Neil Adams issues that we covered, and going to kind of give a blanket coverage of that entire era. It's easy to lump that all into the Lee Kirby era, because obviously the Lee Kirby era was the largest part of that. But we can't forget that there was other stuff going on in those early issues as well. So I suppose we should just get right to it. But before we do that, let's just go ahead and play the music for our review.
Cross the rainbow bridge of Asgard, where the booming heavens roar. You'll behold in breathless wonder the God of Thunder, mighty Thor.
Indeed. So much like our Simonson retrospective that we did quite some time ago now, I'm not going to go issue per issue like saying, well, okay, in Journey into Mystery 88, this happened. In Journey into Mystery 89, this happened. You know, I'm not really going to do that, but just kind of give overall impressions of what I'm thinking about the series, the stories that's going on, the various changes that happened as far as, you know, the personnel, some of the more notable events in the Thor continuity, and how that all ties into what came later. But before we do that, I actually did get a comment here, and this comment is from our good friend Manuel. He does his own podcast called Truthful Comics Podcast. You should go listen to that. And Manuel had this to contribute to their special episode. He says, I want to give some feedback on the Lee Kirby era of comics. It just doesn't sound the same without a smoke alarm going off in the background. Oh, there is one going off in the background. You just probably can't hear it. I want to give some feedback on the Lee Kirby era of comics, but I'm so salty with the whole Stan Lee situation that I feel like I'm going to come across like an ass. So I'll just say this. Don't worry, I'll come across like an ass for you. Their run on Thor, as silly as it may seem at times, it's timeless in that people enjoyed it in the 60s, and recently I've been reading them to my 4-year-old son, and he loves them. Every aspect of these books are like a drug for young minds that crave adventure, excitement, and all-around wonder that a character like the Mighty Thor provides when written by Lee and drawn by the King of Comics. As a Thor fan, I'm grateful that Kirby was on the book as long as he was, because he gave me enough that I can read these books every year and still find something new in the stories. So to end it, long live the king. And that was from our good friend Manuel Carmona of the Mahoning Valley Scrappers. And that joke never gets old. Anyway, so thanks, Manuel, for your input here. So I think that just to start off with, let's talk a little bit about the Lee Kirby dynamic. I don't want to get into the controversy. I'll be honest, I don't. I think I've made my position on the Lee Kirby dynamic abundantly clear. And I try to be fair to everybody involved. None of us were there. None of us know what went on. But one thing that I find is really unique about the Lee Kirby collaboration is that you often get the idea of musicians singing in harmony. You've got obviously the greater bulk of the tune, say the melody, is conveyed by the artwork and the storytelling visually, and the harmony is conveyed by Stan Lee's writing. And as I've often pointed out in the past, when you have a book that Stan Lee is writing and Jack Kirby is drawing, and you compare it to a book where Jack Kirby was doing both the story and the art, there's a big difference It's a difference in tone. It's a difference in the voice of the music. It's a difference in every single way, really. When Kirby was doing his own stuff, he had this, you know, amazing imagination. He could pull anything out. He could do, you never knew what was going to happen next in a Jack Kirby comic. Next issue was always going to be a big surprise, because I get the feeling that Kirby kind of made it all up as he went along. He didn't have long character arcs. He didn't really have character development as such. Lee Kirby, you know, you had Stan Lee, who was more a moderating voice in the partnership. If you look at a New Gods comic and you look at, you know, say Mr. Miracle number one, and you follow that entire run of Mr. Miracle all the way to the end when Kirby left the book and they canceled the book. Scott Free, Mr. Miracle, his character doesn't change at all. This character has no arc. He's the same at the end of the series as he was at the beginning of the series, pretty much. There are small changes. Those come out of the story. Things that he's learned about himself. Things that he learned about his parentage and so forth. I think Mr. Miracle is, to my mind, one of the ultimate Kirby creations, because he was exciting. He was imaginative. He could do a lot of different things with an escape artist. He would always have him in peril. And he was able to come up with these really elaborate traps and things that Mr. Miracle had to get out of. And that is the sort of action-based idea that Jack Kirby liked to push across. You have larger-than-life characters, so much larger-than-life that they are on a cosmic scale. You have Galactus, you have the Silver Surfer, you have these huge characters. Somebody once described this on, I think it was on the Facebook page, as Jack Kirby's stories was big guys beating up other big guys. And I think that's an oversimplification. But that being said, Kirby's characters on their own didn't have any kind of emotional depth. They didn't really have a lot of character development. Like I said, they had very, very short character arcs from the beginning of the story to the end of the story. And that didn't really affect any other story. It was kind of off on its own thing. Now, that's not Kirby's fault as a storyteller. It's the era in which he came up as a storyteller. When you think about it, and you go back to the 1940s comics. Right now, Pete is going through the 1940s Captain America comics and sharing a lot of that stuff with me. Now, Kirby didn't do a ton of those. You might be surprised. He didn't do all that many issues of Captain America, even though he was the co-creator. I think he did like the first 10 issues, and then he went off into the army. So, you know, they had a bunch of lesser lights at that point. But, you know, looking at those, that's just the way it was. Joe Simon wrote those stories. And again, their character arcs really were basically non-existent. You know, that was not something that came into comics until much later. Not until the 1950s, at least. And not even at Marvel, necessarily. I mean, you have a lot of these one-off characters at Marvel. And you have all these monsters and, you know, the kind of characters that didn't really continue on. Until the Marvel Age of Comics begins with Fantastic Four number one. And we'll come back to that. But I'm kind of gotten off the track here. So you have these characters and everybody's adventures are pretty much one and done. You have really short character arcs. And you don't really get in depth into any of these characters. Now, what Stan did that was interesting is he worked on the character dynamics with each other. The Fantastic Four obviously were a family. They had that family dynamic. They had the bratty kid brother who could, you know, lose his temper and go storming off to you know, ride in his hot rod. You had, you know, the Thing who was angry about being a monster and bitter about being a monster. And he kind of softened up later and became a teddy bear. But that was kind of his character arc, wasn't it? And that, I don't think, would have happened if you hadn't had a writer like Stan Lee to shepherd these characters through. You can also see this in other creations that Stan came up with. So it's not like, I think there's a lot of people out there and they're in the Kirby did everything camp. And I'll grant you, Kirby visually created modern comics. He was, you know, perhaps the greatest comic artist ever for that reason alone, because he came up with the visual language of comics in America. It's not so much true in other places like Japan, but even in Japan, though, you'll find sometimes characters are influenced by Kirby. But Stan is what gave the books their heart. And Stan was the one who had these more character-driven stories. Stan was the one who actually had things happen in the comics that carried on into later years. There was real change. You had, and not just a matter of, you know, Reed and Sue getting married and having Franklin and all that stuff, but he was a world builder. And I guess you could say he still is a world builder, but, you know, at 90, whatever he is now, he's not really doing very much of that anymore. We're talking about the Marvel Age, though. At that point, Stan was building worlds that would develop over time. And that's like something like, it's got almost the opposite of what I was talking about as far as like the fourth world. And you had big events happening, but the little events just weren't there. You know, the little events were elusive. And so the characters never really changed. And as amazing as Kirby was as a visual storyteller and in this endless imagination that never exhausted itself, you know, to the end of his life, even later, much later, when the stuff he was doing wasn't very good, it was never a lack of ideas that was the problem. Kirby could come up with, you know, 10,000 ideas a day, and they would all be exciting. Now, they may not be good, but they wouldn't be boring. And that was the one of the great things about Jack Kirby, and one of the things that I really admire him for. And Stan was the one who gave the characters more depth and gave them a heart and actually used that to build the worlds. And so that's my view of the Lee Kirby partnership. And you find that still after Kirby leaves Marvel in the little bit of time when Stan Lee was actively writing comics into the 70s. You know, he was still working on that stuff. You know, the concepts that he came up with are still used in Marvel Comics today. When Stan was writing with other artists, you could still hear Stan's voice in the story. When he was working with an artist like Ditko, or an artist like John Buscema, or an artist like Johnny Romita. And so I'm not, you know, I'm not going to fall into this trap of you know, what a lot of the Kirby fans do, is like Jack did everything, because it's clear he didn't. And that Stan actually did have a profound influence on the characters. And you can't argue that Stan Lee is a great literary writer. You know, I don't claim that he's a great literary writer. But what he did was important to the comics medium. He brought ideas into the comics medium that had never been tried before. You could argue that, you know, the Superman comics, you know, from the 50s on had character development. But the status quo never really changed. By that notion, they were kind of stale. You always knew that even if Lois found out that Clark Kent was Superman, but by the end of the issue, she would somehow forget, or, you know, would be convinced otherwise or whatever, because the status quo couldn't really change. And that was one of the things about DC Comics of that era, and really well into the 1970s, that meant that somebody like Stan could take that familiar comics world, give it a little twist, and make something happen that was really exciting. And that would not have worked without people like Ditko, Kirby, Romita, and Buscema. Because, you know, they were the ones who were doing the visual storytelling that was way different from anything we could see at DC. And we had, you know, the characters bickering and being mad at each other and having their own agendas and so forth, which we didn't really see a lot of at DC. Again, until the 1970s, there was a lot of cross-pollination between Marvel and DC back in the 60s and 70s, but that didn't really start until later in the 60s. When you had, you know, Stan Lee was writing half the titles at Marvel, you didn't get a lot of that. It was just kind of pure Marvel magic all the way through. And then later you had artists and writers going back and forth between DC and Marvel, doing various projects. You know, you had people like Jerry Conway, who wrote a lot of Thor issues, and we'll be getting to them eventually. And people like Roy Thomas, who would go back and forth, you know, all through the 70s and 80s, they were kind of going back and forth between DC and Marvel. And at that point, you started to see the Marvelization of the DC universe, because the storytelling techniques that they learned at Marvel under the guidance of Stan Lee as editor and editor-in-chief were taken over to DC, and we began to see that it's kind of very slowly working its way into the DC psyche, and that made the DC comics better too. So I don't think it can be argued that Stan was enormously influential, not just at Marvel Comics, but a DC Comics as well. Now let's talk more specifically about Thor, because that's what we're here for. As you all know, it all began in Journey into Mystery number 83. The cover blares, introducing the mighty Thor, the most exciting superhero of all. Begin the saga of Thor in this issue. And, you know, like a lot of these early comics, there's no credits. You know, this is written by Stan Lee and drawn by Jack Kirby. And notably, it was the last time that was going to happen for a while. A very inconsistent art job by Kirby. We've got some beautiful inking. I don't know if Kirby was inking himself here or whether it was somebody like, George Roussos or somebody like that. And now we've got an interesting new character who's not really like anybody else that we've seen in comics. Now, my good friend Walt Grogan would argue, and has argued, that Thor is a riff on Captain Marvel Jr. I can see the similarities. We have the secret identity. We have lame Dr. Blake as opposed to the lame Freddie Freeman over in the Captain Marvel series. You know, so there are similarities, but I don't think that they were deliberate. I think that they were definitely, if there was an influence at all, it was probably a subconscious one. Other than that superficial little bit of similarity, the two characters are really nothing alike. Now, it's interesting that they threw him into Journey into Mystery. I think this was done before Spider-Man. Now, somebody could correct me if I'm wrong about that. But basically, Journey into Mystery was a book on the verge of cancellation. It wasn't selling well. You know, it had giant monster stories and pretty stereotypical sci-fi stories of the day. A lot of stuff drawn by Steve Ditko. There was a lot of little mysteries, and that's kind of what Journey into Mystery was all about. Now, why take over a book like Journey into Mystery when you could start with a new Thor number one? Well, there was a problem with that. And if you go back and look at Marvel Comics' The Untold Story, and there's other good references as well, one of the reasons why they did that, which they also did with Amazing Fantasy when they introduced Spider-Man, was that they could only distribute so many books a month. DC Comics controlled comics distribution at that time, so other companies were restricted in the number of titles that they could actually publish. So one way to get around that would be, rather than keep both of those series going, would be for a new feature to try out in a series like Journey into Mystery, and then if it was successful, either stay in that title, or they'd go ahead and cancel the one book and start the other one from number one. Thor was, one of those concepts that, okay, let's try it out here, and then if it sells well, then we'll do something else with it. And obviously, the first Thor was a big success, and so they went on from there. And eventually, the book began selling well enough that with issue number 125, it became The Mighty Thor. But it's easy to forget that the Thor series really kind of got off to a rough start. We had an initial really strong Lee Kirby issue, and then we had some problems. Stan didn't have time to write the issues, so he passed it off to his younger brother Larry to do the scripting. Stan would still come up with a plot, feed it to Larry, his brother, and Larry would write it. And we also have Kirby not doing his best work, and I think it's obvious why. I mean, Kirby was really overextended during this period, and he couldn't draw every book in the line. So, Thor being the newest was the one that was the least important, and so it ended up having, not quite the quality of Kirby that we would come to enjoy later. To the point where Kirby actually left the book. Artwork went to other people. We had Don Heck coming in for a few issues, which was not very good. We had Al Hartley come in for an issue. And then we had a series of issues that were very well drawn by none other than Joe Sinnott. Now, Joe Sinnott being more known as a Marvel inker than as a Marvel penciler, did some beautiful work on the series, which culminated in Journey into Mystery number 96, in which Thor fights Merlin the Mad. And I always thought that was just a beautifully, beautifully drawn issue. I would have loved to see what kind of penciler Sinnott would turn into had he continued on the path, had he continued to draw comics as a regular thing. And we know that Joe Sinnott is a talented artist because he's done comics kind of off on his own, not for Marvel or DC. I think he did the life of Pope John the 23rd, and he's done other stuff as well. He does a lot of illustrations and baseball sketches and that kind of thing. And if you're not a Facebook friend with Joe Sinnott, you should go find him and join, because they're always posting interesting work from him. So certainly artistically, things were all over the place in these first 17 issues, but things were kind of all over the place as far as the writing as well. One of the jokes I used to tell a lot about in the story was that every third issue, every three issues, you would have aliens, communists, and Loki as the villain. And then it would just recycle aliens, communists, Loki. And that's basically the way it was for the first couple of years that Thor was around. And it got to be a little bit predictable and tedious. The other thing that always struck me as really odd, and especially from the very beginning of the series, was that Jack Kirby seemed to have something against trees. And Thor or the villains were always destroying trees. And I guess that, it became a theme of sorts. Now the point that we are in the series now, you really don't have a lot of that anymore. The tree murder theme seems to have worked its way out of the series over time. But it was certainly really amusing in the first few issues, because, it started with Journey into Mystery 83, and Stan and Larry and Robert Burns just kind of took all their cues off those first few issues to continue on for a year or two. And then we really get into the meat of the Lee Kirby era. With Journey into Mystery number 98, we now have Lee and Kirby reunited on the book. And immediately, the book became a much better book. This is the beginning of the classic Thor era. You can basically break down the Lee Kirby run on Thor into three eras. You have the very beginning, where you have a lot of uncertainty in the stories. You have a lot of different artists. You have, three different writers on the book. You have the classic Thor era, which was that 5 years in between 1963 and 1968. And then you have the series winding down at the end, the era where the Lee Kirby team is not as strong as it used to be, where Kirby was starting to get disgruntled and thinking about leaving Marvel, and then finally did leave Marvel. But starting with Journey into Mystery number 98, we have that dream team together, and they don't split up for a long time. This is where the character development really starts to happen. We've had this annoying character of Jane Foster, who was really a cipher. She had no real personality. She was, characterized so inconsistently that the character came across as really unhinged and insane. There's really no reason, if written well, Jane Foster can't be a great character. And you can see, that the character obviously has endured into the present day, and even in the current Girl Thor series, she makes appearances. But at that time, it wasn't a good character, and she wasn't handled well. And because of that, it reflected very poorly on her. Of course, it made for great comedy when we were covering those issues. She's a lot of fun to make fun of. But I don't think that that's necessarily what Stan had in mind. Stan being notoriously sexist in the 1960s, particularly in the early 1960s, it's still, even by those standards, Jane just seemed to be unhinged and really fickle and inconsistent. And that's why a lot of people, and including myself, never liked that character back in those days. Now, that changed kind of slowly over time. And it really kind of started here with Journey into Mystery number 98. And you then start seeing immediately all of the hallmarks of the Lee Kirby era. You have the first Tales of Asgard appear in Journey into Mystery number 97. You have the first regular villains other than Loki coming into the Thor mythos. Now, granted, it was lame ones like the Cobra and Mr. Hyde. This is where the world building of the Thor series really begins. You have the return of Zarko the Tomorrow Man. You have the Executioner and the Enchantress for the first time. There was a little bit too much Cobra and Mr. Hyde in this era for me. But you also have, characters like the Grey Gargoyle and Magneto. And you have this kind of epic battle with the Hulk in Journey into Mystery 112. And a lot is going on here, kind of messing around with the status quo. You have Thor trying to reveal his secret identity to Jane. You have the introduction of the Absorbing Man, my favorite Thor villain, and you have just a lot going on here, and that kind of culminates in what I really think of as the very beginning of the height of the Lee Kirby era, and that is Journey into Mystery number 118, the introduction of the Destroyer. It was a really strong story. It was Lee and Kirby at the height of their powers. It had a lot of action, and it had a lot of gravitas. And you ended up with a whole series of brilliant stories. You have, you know, Thor breaking his hammer and then having to go up against the Absorbing Man. You have the introduction of Hercules into the Marvel Universe in Journey into Mystery 124, and this whole Pluto storyline that came after that. There was just one thing after another, and then you have Thor, after defeating Pluto, going off into space and meeting Ego, the living planet, and the Recorder. And there's some turkeys in there. I mean, you know, Thor number 135, where Thor fights the Super Beast, is not any kind of not any kind of great story. And then you have Jane going to Asgard in 136 and trying to become an immortal. Yeah, so not every story is a winner. And then you have one after another, figures that became huge in the Marvel Universe being introduced. We have the High Evolutionary in 134. You know, obviously, we have the colonizers of Rigel, who are still around today. Ulic the Troll in 137. We have Galactus coming into the Thor series for the first time. We have the Super Skrull. We have, you know, Thor, Baldur, and Sif coming to Earth. Thor loses his powers in issue number 144. We have the Ringmaster and the Circus of Crime coming in. It's just one thing after another, and just all of these really iconic characters coming in. You know, and on top of that, we've actually been kind of all along in small steps exploring the world of Asgard. This is obviously hugely important to the series. Now, if you really think about it, back in the beginning of the Lee Kirby era, actually all through the Lee Kirby era, Thor doesn't really have a supporting cast on Earth. He's got Jane, and that's pretty much it. You take it into Asgard, you've got an entire universe of supporting cast that have continued to this day. In introducing all of these characters from the Norse lore, obviously we started out, the very first Norse god other than Thor to appear in a Thor story was Heimdall. And he ends up getting a leaf in his eye, and it makes him cry because he's a wimp. But we have we have Heimdall, and we have Baldur, and we have Sif, and we have Odin. And at the start, most of these characters are pretty much ciphers, and it took a long time to sort of develop these characters into who they would become. And as time went on, the Asgard mythos became stronger and stronger and stronger. So you had not only the other gods, but you also had, you know, the trolls, and you had Carnilla, the Norn Queen. You had lots of little dramas going on with that. Issue number 155, we get the first appearance of Mangog, who has gone on to appear again and again in Thor comics. I don't think that we can underestimate here the influence of the Tales of Asgard backups, because this was a really important tool to play around with some of these new ideas. Stan and Jack bringing in characters like Harrokin, and let's not forget, the Warriors 3 came from what seemed like just kind of a one-off appearance in one of these Tales of Asgard backups, and here they are. I mean, they're in the big budget movies. So, obviously, very important characters to the mythos. It's just this really endless imagination of Lee and Kirby together, working as a team, coming up with these amazing concepts. And so those are the height of Lee Kirby and their powers. And I think that really you can kind of sum it all up. I think one of the very best that I have found of the Thor series, the one that probably to me is the very pinnacle, would be what Thor Annual number 2. And you know, that we just take kind of where everything fell into place. And everything just kind of was firing on all cylinders. And then after that, it was just kind of this kind of slow slope downward. And we have the Lee Kirby run coming to its last 20 issues, and the quality visibly declined from issue to issue. for me, I think that slide starts about issue number 160. Well, it wasn't anything in particular. The second Galactus story. This is the story where Thor goes off and seeks Galactus for Odin. It's not a bad story at all, and it leads to this kind of epic smackdown between Galactus and Ego, the Living Planet. But I think that that's the last great Lee Kirby story, and at that point, things start to deteriorate a little bit. We have a kind of a lackluster appearance by Pluto in the story, so Thor number 163 through 164. We have the first appearance outside of the Fantastic Four of him, which is kind of it's not a great story, you know. And, of course, that character went on to become Adam Warlock, and, you know, of course, that led on to all kinds of other things. And we have a lot going on here. You know, another appearance by Galactus. We have the invasion of the Thermal Man, the return of the Wrecker. But these aren't great stories, and they're not memorable appearances by those characters. This is getting to an era here in the late 60s where you could tell that Lee and Kirby weren't feeling it anymore. You had the art began to suffer. You had the writing begin to suffer. We had almost untellable stories here. And that kind of culminated in this Crypto Man story in Thor number 174, which is kind of a steaming pile. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here that's not great, but it just kind of, every issue got a little bit lower, a little bit lower, a little bit lower. And it kind of ends up in this swapping of minds story, which was Lee and Kirby's last story arc on the book. And actually, Kirby leaves in the middle of it. And the story is finished by Neil Adams on pencil. This is the only time that I know of that Stan Lee and Neil Adams worked together. And when I talked with Neil Adams at C2E2 last year, he said it was the way he told the story was pretty interesting, in that he really had a lot of say in how the story was done. It was Adams' idea to make it a two-parter. Now, I think that Adams was misremembering that they picked it up in the middle of a story, because that was not something that he mentioned. But the story did actually finish. We actually had it begin in a very Lee Kirby fashion, you know, with this mask being created that switched Loki and Thor's bodies, and that ended up finishing in the Neil Adams story. And basically where we left off, I mean, I think the last story we covered was number 181. So I guess you could say that, you know, the Silver Age of comics ends there. And then we enter into the Bronze Age, kind of right in the middle of that last story. And it's interesting. It's interesting to look at these now. And of course, we had a really excruciating fill-in in number 178, where we had the Stranger and the Abomination. But the 70s were full of fill-in issues. We're going to have more of them, folks. I mean, not all of them are winners. And usually, these inventory stories are nothing special. But once it became obvious that things were not happy in Marvel Land and that Lee and Kirby were not working as the team they once were, it was a quick downward slide. There were a lot of stories that were just not that good. We had the departure of Vince Coletta as inker, which I believe that Coletta was let go to make Kirby happy because he wasn't happy with the way that Coletta inked his pencils. And we had Bill Everett come in. Now, Everett was different, but he wasn't necessarily a ton better. There were some places where he was a lot better than Coletta, but still not the greatest inker over Kirby. I mean, it takes a special kind of inker, I think, to really look good on Kirby pencils. Both Vinnie Coletta and Bill Everett had a similar kind of scratchy line, and I don't think that that's the kind of inks that work well on Kirby. I think you need to have a smooth line like Chick Stone or Mike Royer to really make Kirby's pencils pop. But where it really all falls down is when you have the partnership breaking down. Lee without Kirby is like Lennon without McCartney. They're still talented artists in their own right, but the excitement of them working together is not something that you could ever recapture. If you look back on this run, this is the foundation for everything that Thor had come later. Even in the year after Stan Lee left the book, you basically had, you know, Roy Thomas and Jerry Conway and other writers and artists coming in and rehashing these same concepts. We had the return of the Mangog. We had the return of Ulick. We had, you know, the return of the Absorbing Man. Every so often, we would have a story about Loki, you know. And all of this was built on this solid foundation of Lee and Kirby at their absolute height. So many good ideas came spilling out of this run of Thor that persist into the Marvel Universe today. If you look in the 1980s, we had, you know, the Evolutionary War series, which was one of those Marvel annual crossovers that they had one summer. And, you know, the High Evolutionary, where did he start? Well, it was a Thor issue. And I think it was a particularly lame Thor issue where Jane was teaching animal people, like, basic math and stuff. Yeah, but that's not to say, even a lame idea like that became a big thing in the Marvel Universe later. And I don't think that Kirby could have done it alone. I certainly don't think that Stan could have done it alone. And it's just one of those things of you had that magic going in that place at that time. And really, when you think about it, a really brief period of time. The Lee Kirby era was 7 years. 7 years is nothing in today's comics. You know, that was a really exciting 7-year run. And it's really easy to forget that, you know, that classic Marvel era was really 1961 to 1970. If you take it from Fantastic Four number one, you're talking 9 years or 8 years. And, you know, that's a lot of ideas that just came spilling out of that creative wellspring over that 8 or 9 years. And all of the success that Marvel has had in the time since then has been because of that partnership. Now, Lee and Kirby, of course, weren't the be-all and end-all of Marvel Comics in the 60s and 70s. There were a lot of other talented people that were also a part of that. Each of them contributed in their own unique way into making this giant magical universe work. But I don't think it can be denied that among this horde of truly talented people who were making the Marvel Universe what it was, at the very forefront of this, you have Jack Kirby and Stan Lee leading the charge. It's just kind of unfortunate that over such a short period of time of you know, maybe a year and a half to 2 years, that it all just seemed to kind of fall apart. All right, so I think I've yammered on about enough about all this stuff. But once again, folks, thanks very much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If you want to email the show, you can certainly do so. The email address is radiofreeasgard@gmail.com. And also, folks, don't forget, we're going to be at C2E2. Yeah, Pete and I are going to be at C2E2 on Sunday, April 26th. It is the shortest day of the convention, but, you know, that's kind of what we wanted. And we're going to be trying to get Stan Lee's autograph. So if you go to the Stan Lee line and look for me, you'll probably find me waiting there. I'm going to try to get him to sign something that he wrote. And hopefully have a great time at the convention. If anybody else is going and you want to meet up, shoot me a line over on Facebook or shoot me an email to radiofreeasgard@gmail.com. And we'll see about hooking up at the convention. And with that, we are going back over the Rainbow Bridge, forming our Ajax White Tornado, whirling our way back to Midgard. And we'll see you next time here on Radio Free Asgard. You have been listening to Radio Free Asgard, a production of Tom Harris USA Productions, which is totally responsible for its content. The Mighty Thor and all associated characters are mostly copyright Marvel Comics. The stories presented are done so for educational, review, and entertainment purposes only. No ownership is implied. The silly voices, however, well, they're all me. Musical selections from Eden, The Invincible Sword of the Elfsmith, are copyright Mots Vent and are used with permission. If you like what you've heard on the show, we hope you'll leave us a review on iTunes, tell your friends, or even join our Facebook group. We really love hearing from our listeners, and we appreciate all of your support. Thanks once again very much for listening to Radio Free Asgard.